Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. It's January 9th, 2019. I am Charlie Sykes, the editor of The Bulwark. You can subscribe to us on Apple, Stitcher, any of the places where you can find podcasts. And we are very, very lucky to have a special guest today, Steve Kornacki, who you know from the big board on MSNBC and NBC, and he is the author of a fascinating new book, The Red and the Blue, The 1990s and the Birth of Political Tribalism. Hey, thanks for joining me today, Steve.
Yeah, no, Charlie, this is a bit of a role reversal. I'm used to asking you questions when you're on MSNBC, so I guess we'll turn the tables here a little bit.
We will. You know, one thing that I think people don't fully understand is how scary that big board is. It is scary, isn't it? I mean, the reason I'm asking that is that, you know, even the best technology is going to break down on you.
Yeah.
And you're on live national television in front of that board, and you're hostage.
I am, and it breaks down. I hate to say it, it breaks down a lot. And I was up there the other day. It was I was sitting in for Hardball last week, and we had just one of those, you know, everything that can go wrong does go wrong moments. And I said to myself, here we go. Now it's 2019, and what's old is new again. It's one of those. It's very complicated. There's so many layers to it. And, you know, press the button, you have the whole thing planned out, and then the screen freezes and you're left to improvise.
But you know what? I think I was actually watching that episode, and I did think, kudos to you because of the professionalism. You're out there, you know, you have no net, and there it is. And, of course, you know all of this stuff. Well, I want to talk about, obviously, there's a lot going on in American politics, but let's look back on this. And, I'm one of those people that have been trying to figure out what the hell happened. How did we get to where we are today? So I find your book absolutely fascinating, and it is a look at the 1990s when, you know, really where you trace the rise of our modern version of tribalism from, say, you know, the presidency of George H.W. Bush up to election night on 2000, Newt Gingrich, Bill Clinton, all of those folks. And you know, I wrote a book about, you know, how the right lost its mind, and in retrospect, I did not spend enough time on the role of Newt Gingrich. And as I was reading, it's like he really is a pivotal figure in the tone and the nature and the style of our politics today, isn't he?
I really think so, and I think that's what kept jumping out at me, just going back and, you know, through the archives, through the C-SPAN, you know, video archives, because so much of what Newt did, you can kind of pair the rise of Newt's career with the rise of C-SPAN and television cameras in Congress, which coincided, the beginning of that coincided with Gingrich coming to Congress. And I think he just, what really jumped out at me is that I think Newt saw where it was going. It was probably, I think, going to end up, you know, like this almost no matter what. I don't know if it's always going to end up with Trump or anything like that, but I think just the rise of first polarization, then tribalism, you know, that sort of thing, that the merger of sort of television culture and politics, I think a lot of these things were eventually going to happen. But I think Newt spotted it early. I think he accelerated it. And I think he plays obviously just a pivotal role. It was in understanding. I think that the real basic thing was, here was somebody who came to Congress in 1979, and he was a gadfly in the minority party, the Republican Party. At that point, the Republicans had been the minority party for a generation. They weren't even close. People called it the permanent Democratic Congress.
And it felt that way.
Yeah. That's what
Newt, a lot of people forget this now, who've lived through this, how inconceivable a Republican Congress was for 4 decades.
I mean, we just had, you know, we spent 2 years in the run up to 2018 asking the question, you know, will Democrats get that net gain of 23 seats and take back the House? We never said it's impossible. But yes, you're right. For decades, you know, we never had the conversation in the run up to an election of, hey, could the Republicans get it back? It was just taken as a given that the Democrats would run it. The speakership was, you know, that gavel was handed down like this, you know, a hereditary instrument. You know, one 65-year-old Democrat, you know, takes it for 10 years, mm-hmm. then hands it off to another. And Newt, basically, he came in there and he told Republicans, I'm going to take you to the majority someday. And what powered him was a sense, two things. I think number one was a sense that institutionally, one was a sense among Republican leaders that, yeah, this was just the way things were. And then there was a sense among, you know, sort of younger Republican members that, hey, you know, we're getting walked all over by the Democrats here, and our leaders aren't doing anything about it. And Newt was the guy who he recognized with that camera that he had an opportunity to go around the major media, you know, ABC, CBS, NBC, all of that. No cable news really back then, but to go around that and to go to the grassroots, people just getting cable television for the first time, flipping through their dial. They come to this channel and late at night, that's what it was. He found this sort of obscure rule that let him claim time on the floor as long as he wanted, talk about whatever he wanted. The chamber was empty. All the members, you know, said, well, there's no official business. They were out, you know, playing poker or doing their fundraisers or whatever. And Newt was, you would look back at it now, you watch these late night speeches Newt gave in the 80s, and they are like a forerunner, I think, to cable news. It's like a cable news monologue, what you would now recognize as that. And slowly but surely, he built a following nationally in the grassroots. And he was able to change Congress sort of from the outside in, I think. I just think of that, and I think of what Trump did with Twitter 30 years later, and I see some parallels.
Oh, the parallels are very, very striking. And, you know, he weaponized, of course, television and introduced a kind of, you know, weaponization of politics. But what was interesting in the framing of the book is go back to the beginning, that the 1990s, you know, even if 1990s was the decade of Newt Gingrich, it began with you start with this what now looks like this obsolete grand gesture of bipartisanship, that 1990 budget agreement where George H.W. Bush famously broke his promise and came up with a budget deal that was really sort of the last, I mean, kind of feels like kind of a last gasp of the Republican establishment, the way that Washington used to do things. And that really began to shape the dynamics, especially when people like Gingrich decided that that was the ultimate betrayal and that they needed to redefine what the Republican Party was all about.
Yeah. I mean, that was there was always this conflict, I think, for George H.W. Bush as he climbed toward the presidency between what he really was politically and where the Republican Party was going. And, you know, of course, he'd run for president in 1980 against Reagan in the primaries. Reagan in 80, you know, had embraced the supply side idea, tax cuts, and Bush in the 1980 campaign ran as the moderate, and he called, you know, Reagan's plan voodoo economics. That was the term in the 80 campaign. And then, of course, they come to the peace afterwards. Reagan Bush becomes the vice president, and then Bush basically builds his 88 presidential campaign in part on convincing the Reagan wing of the party, that tax cutting wing, you know, actually, guys, I'm one of you. And that's what the 88 convention speech, when he says, read my lips, no new taxes, that's the audience he was going for. He was this was just going to convince them once and for all that he was not the moderate they remember, that he was a Reaganite and a Gingrichite in a way, too. Gingrich wasn't quite that big in 88, but Gingrich was definitely part of that wing in Congress. And then it comes to it 2 years later. OK, Bush has warned in his speech, Democrats in Congress will come to me. They'll say the deficit is high. They'll say you need to raise taxes. I'll stare them down. I'll say, read my lips. Well, it happens 2 years later. The Democrats say deficits are through the roof. You got to raise taxes. And Bush does the opposite. He does what is real, what he really is. He says, okay, we're going to compromise. I'm going to raise taxes. And it's that moment where you can understand. I mean, I think you can go back in time and you can understand the logic of a lot of this from sort of a Gingrichite standpoint that, you know, hey, I thought we made a stand. I thought we decided in the 80s we're the anti-tax party. I thought Bush had decided that. And how can we now just turn around and say, read my lips meant nothing? And so it's this civil war in the Republican Party. That Gingrich kills the first deal on the floor of the House. Bush has to make a new deal with Democrats. And Bush, the thing that I think ultimately changes things long term is Bush believes this deal is going to rescue the economy and get elected in 92. And when Bush loses in 92, the lesson that a lot of Republicans take is just tactically Gingrich is right, because tactically making a deal with Democrats, tactically raising taxes to fight the deficit, it didn't save the economy in Bush in 92.
And then, of course, he goes on in 1994 with the contract with America to do the unthinkable. The other major character in your book, and you have so many rich characters, and of course, I remember this. Where were you in the 1990s? What were you doing?
I was a dorky middle school, high school kid. Okay, believe me, I remember it too. So I have a perspective is shaded by by youth and naivete, but I do remember a lot.
No, I mean, I remember all of this, and I was a conservative talk show host, so I was very much a part of this. So I remember how this played out, and I remember what we were thinking at the time, and looking back and going, okay, was that really a good idea? But so now we have the character of Bill Clinton, and here you have Newt Gingrich, who is taking the Republican Party to the right, attacking centrism. And Bill Clinton is trying to remake the Democratic Party. It's really an extraordinary effort, you know, to, you know, shift his party's ideology, you know, to some sort of a center. He's trying to occupy that space. And really, it is sort of, when you think about the reading your book, that the story of the 1990s is this collapse of the center in many ways, the collapse of the politics of compromise, because Bill Clinton really, well, tell me what your take on that is.
No, I think that's exactly right, because the talk about that tension on the Republican side between, you know, Bush Sr., the tradition he represented, and then where the Republican Party was going, that definitely existed on the Democratic side with Bill Clinton. I mean, Bill Clinton, the whole idea of centrism that he ran on, you know, a different kind of Democrat, that was his mm-hmm. slogan in 1992. It was an answer to the rejection, just the mass rejection of Democratic candidates for three straight elections before that. I mean, again, it's something else we don't have today. We do not have landslide presidential elections like we had in the 80s. I mean, Mondale losing 49 states to Ronald Reagan, you know, Dukakis losing 40 in 88. I mean, we start out now, you pencil 20 into each party's column, and then you kind of go from there. The scale of these defeats for Democrats, one after the other, there was just the sense, as much as the sense was, hey, Republicans could never take back the Congress, it was also Democrats could never win back the White House. So,
well, you're also reminding us just how fundamentally our politics has changed, because, you know, at the start of the decade, you did have this, you know, string of blowout victories. By the end of the decade, we were entering into the blue and red. We're getting ahead of ourselves here. So
yeah. Exactly. It's such a huge transformation, and it's such a short period of time. And I think Clinton was. The idea of Clinton as he ran in 92 was that he was the implicit promise to Americans was, hey, you are skeptical of the Democratic Party. You are skeptical of liberalism. I am going to be I will myself be a moderating check on that as mm-hmm. president. And in the Gingrich challenge, when Bill Clinton becomes president in 93, Gingrich is sort of the main shaping force of the Republican opposition on Capitol Hill. And the Gingrich strategy is, hey, you know, make the country see that Bill Clinton is not a moderate. Make the country see that when push comes to shove, Bill Clinton is like any other, you know, liberal Democrat. And in the first 2 years of the Clinton presidency, it is Clinton teaming up with the Democratic Congress on these very ambitious things, health care reform, you know, Hillary Clinton, you know, deputizing Hillary Clinton to run the health care task force. You know, he tries to put a stimulus through. He puts a tax hike through, you know, a couple of years after the Bush mm-hmm. tax. Here's Bill Clinton who ran. Bill Clinton ran in 92 saying, I'll cut middle class taxes. I'm a different kind of Democrat. I will cut middle class taxes. One of his first actions after taking office is to say, same thing as George Bush Sr. Hey, folks, the deficit's higher than I thought. I'm not going to be able to do it. Instead, I'm putting this tax increase through. And he said the tax increase, he's saying, you know, it isn't really a middle class tax, but it does hit the gas tax mm-hmm. and all these things. So he played into Gingrich's hands in the sense that Gingrich was able to tell voters, see, there really is no difference. And that sets the stage for 1994, which is just, it's the Republican Revolution. It's especially in the South, but it's obviously it's all over the country. Voters who had been rejecting Democratic presidential candidates now rejecting Democratic candidates for Congress and giving Republicans for the first time in 40 years the House.
And Democrats really did not see that coming. So of all of the pre-Trumpian figures that you write about in this book, who was the most Trump-like, or the John the Baptist too. I'm gonna regret this analogy. Was it Gingrich? Was it Ross Perot? Was it Pat Buchanan? All of those figures that were out there, and if you trace them, if you drew a line from each one of them to Trumpism, which one is the straightest line, do you think, or is that it?
That's the Trinity, to continue your religious metaphor. I think there's pieces of all of them. It's forgotten now that Trump actually essentially ran for president in 2000. You know, he mm-hmm. didn't actually get to the general election, but wanted to run as an independent, as a Reform Party candidate. I think the experience of Ross Perot sort of a populist billionaire influenced that, what he saw Perot do. Gingrich, I think clearly there's overlap there. But I think Buchanan is the biggest. Mm-hmm. Just what Buchanan represented.
I think you're right.
Yeah, and I just, you can go back and look. He ran in 92. When he ran in 92, it was regarded by the press at the time, by the political world of the time, as just a protest vote against Bush for raising taxes, essentially. He was running on a much more fulsome platform than that, Buchanan was, but that's how it was regarded. It was in 96 when he ran again, and he broke through. He almost won Iowa. He won New mm-hmm. Hampshire. He had Bob Dole on the ropes, and it was with, he called it conservatism of the heart. And it was a wall on the southern border with Mexico, a 5-year pause on all immigration, on all legal immigration. It was tearing up trade deals like NAFTA that he said were costing American jobs. It was about
sounds familiar. Yeah,
it was all there, and it was one of those moments. It so many parallels to 2016 where Republicans looked at the success Buchanan had in those 96 primaries. They were terrified because they thought he was unelectable. They didn't want that to be the brand of their party. They were also stunned to find out how deep that sentiment went within their party. They were able to check it in 1996. They were able to unite the party around Bob Dole in the South Carolina primary. Dole wins there, you know, and he's able to hold Buchanan in check. But you saw the roots of it, I think, there in the 90s.
Yeah, no, I do think, and the echoes are so striking. You found and I know this was in the Washington Post review of your book, You found a letter that Donald Trump actually an op-ed piece that he wrote in the New York Times when he quit the Reform Party. And it's interesting the language he used. The Reform Party now includes a Klansman, Mr. David Duke, a neo-Nazi, Mr. Buchanan, and a communist. He's referring to Lenora Fulani. So back then, obviously, the Donald Trump of the 1990s was not a Buchananite, even though I agree with you completely that he really, you know, becomes an acolyte later. But the fact that he referred to Buchanan then as a neo-Nazi, so somehow this racialized and nativist rhetoric that Buchanan had used that was unacceptable to Donald Trump made a comeback 2 decades later.
This is the part that I have struggle the most to get my head around. Mm-hmm. We talk about that term, the resistance, today. The first member of the resistance was Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And it is that Reform Party. You know, Buchanan runs twice for the Republican nomination in the summer and fall of 99. He's running again, and George W. Bush is locking down all the endorsements, all the money, and Buchanan declares the process rigged and says, okay, I'm going to run for this Reform Party nomination. You know, Perot mm-hmm. started this party. It's out there. And then Trump steps forward and says, I don't want this guy, Pat Buchanan, to be the nominee of the Reform Party. I'm going to have to run against him. And he says he's going to have to run against him for exactly the reasons you're describing. He calls him a xenophobe. He calls him a racist. He goes on Meet the Press and says this. He does this. This was this just sticks out in my mind. He went out to Southern California, Trump did at one point, and invited the media along, took a tour of the Museum of Tolerance in Los Angeles, and then came out and said, you know, I hope Pat Buchanan takes a visit here. He could learn a lot from this place. You're right. David Duke was playing footsie with Buchanan throughout the 1990s, including in that campaign. Trump is denouncing him. I mean, remember that moment in the 2016 campaign when you know, Trump was, you know, was essentially playing dumb about Duke. He was saying things about him. Trump had no problem coming out right away and saying, you know, Buchanan needs to denounce this guy. The fact that he won't, deeply disturbing at everything you're saying. And yes, he ends up, what ended up happening was the Reform Party nomination was given out at a convention, and it required creating a real political organization, getting delegates, that sort of thing. Buchanan was absolutely cleaning Trump's clock when it came to that. Trump was a media, the media fueled thing back then, too. So Trump needed a way out. He also wasn't really catching on in the polls nationally. So he needed a way out. And that it's February 2000. He writes this op-ed in the New York Times, everything you just said. And, of course, he ends it by saying, but you know what? I enjoyed running for president a lot. Maybe I'll do it again someday.
So, you know, I look back on the 1990s. One other thing, you know, the whole impeachment scandal involving Bill Clinton. And I've long thought that Democrats underestimate the shock to the system of Bill Clinton you know, having sex in the Oval Office, lying about it, and then basically having the Democratic Party still rally around him. In so many, we live in an age of whataboutism. I don't think that Donald Trump, and with all of his scandals, is possible without Bill Clinton in the late 1990s. And the way that the Democrats decided that, okay, we thought that you know, sexual misconduct was disqualifying earlier in the decade, but we've changed our standards. As long as the policies are okay, we're willing to overlook the character, which seems awfully familiar. I do see the echoes of people who are saying the policy is more important than character, but that really is still the aftershocks of the 1990s, isn't it?
That's one of those. I think writing this book and obviously writing this book, researching it as the Trump era plays out, has brought me around closer to the view that you're expressing there. One thing I start to realize too is just, you know, things happen so quickly in politics and they seem forgotten, you know, and a lot of things are forgotten in a day, a week, an hour these days. But big things are remembered and they're remembered for a long time. And political, we talk about tribalism, political tribes remember big things for a long time. And I do think, look, the great what if to me, in this book is the start of the 92 campaign. And it's December 20th, 1991. It's the filing deadline for the New Hampshire primary. The most popular Democrat in America is Mario Cuomo by far. He's 30 points ahead of Bill Clinton in the polls if he gets in the race. He's kept the entire political world guessing for 10 weeks. Is he going to run or not? He has a plane idling that's going to take him to New Hampshire. He decides not to run, stays out of the race. Only then does Bill Clinton become the front runner. And with such weak opposition, Bill Clinton's able to survive all those scandals in 1992. My what if is, what if Mario Cuomo gets on that plane? And if Mario Cuomo and not Bill Clinton becomes the Democrat who breaks the Republican lock on the Electoral College, becomes president, I'm not good with counterfactuals and who knows, but I do not think that if you get Mario Cuomo, I think two things. I think number one, I don't think you get the sexual politics, that aspect of the culture wars that you got with Clinton. I don't think you have the Clintons looming over national politics for the next generation. So that, you know, you fast forward to 2016, I always think of, you know, there was that second presidential debate. It was held, 2 days after the Access Hollywood tape comes out. And there's Donald Trump. Everybody, you know, people have called from all weekend to get out of the race on the Republican side. He shows up at the debate. Who does he have in tow? He has all the Clinton accusers in tow. Well, what if we never knew about any of the Clinton accusers? What if there was never a President Bill Clinton? What if the lesson of the Clinton 92 campaign was, hey, this guy tried to run for president with all this baggage and Mario Cuomo wiped him out? You know, that is my big what if.
I think that's fascinating, because I argued at the time, and I agree with you. I think there's no way that Donald Trump survives that weekend if it was not for Bill Clinton, if it was not for what happened in the 1990s, which, of course, now raises the question, what are we going to be talking about 20 years from now, 30 years from now? Because at some point, Donald Trump leaves the political scene. But these issues and these precedents are going to be with us for a very, very long time. Steve, I wish we had more time to talk about. I want to talk to you about 2020. Maybe we can have you back on all of this. Everything is moving so quickly. But I really appreciate you joining me today. The book is The Red and the Blue, The 1990s and the Birth of Political Tribalism, from HarperCollins Publishers. It is a fascinating, it is a great read. And thanks for reminding folks, Steve, that you know, people on TV can really write well. So this was an outstanding read, and I appreciate you talking with us today.
That's nice of you to say, Charlie. Thanks. This was a lot of fun.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow.